What happens when a ship gets stranded in pack ice at the North Pole? Hampton Sides will join us to talk about his new book, In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette.
These are extreme stories of hardship and travails, and we'd like to know, how would we deal with this situation? How would we survive it? Or could we survive it?
Is it still possible for an American manufacturer to avoid offshoring to China? Beth Macy will join us to talk about her new book, Factory Man.
I've met a lot of those workers, and I've seen him interact with them, and I think he did it to protect, like, his family legacy. He really cares about those people that for generations made his family rich.
And John Williams will have bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Hampton Sides joins me now. He is the author, most recently, of In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette, reviewed this week in the book review by Robert Harris. Hi, Hampton.
Hey, good to be with you.
So this is an incredible narrative history. Tell us the story of the USS Jeannette.
Well, it's the story of one of the first American attempts on the North Pole, the voyage of the USS Jeannette, which was a Navy vessel that tried to sail through the Bering Strait to the North Pole in 1879, based on some science at the time which said that there was a warm water current that swept through the Bering Straits, softened up the ice, and led to what was thought to be at the top of the world, which was something called the Open Polar Sea. Needless to say, they didn't find this Open Polar Sea, and they ended up getting stuck in the ice for 2 years, drifting about 1,000 miles to the north until their vessel finally sank to the bottom of the Arctic Ocean, leaving these men out on the ice pack with their dogs and trying to get home. So in many ways, it's a survival story about them trying to reach home via Siberia.
Many mishaps on the way, the key word, of course, being attempt, because they did not succeed. Let's go back to this open polar sea theory. Where did this idea come from? It seems so strange to us today that there was a time where we didn't know that the North Pole was indeed made of ice.
There were all kinds of theories about what was up there, and it drove people crazy during the 1800s not to know that there was these few places left on the planet that had never been touched by man. The theory of the open polar sea went back to the Greeks and the Vikings and some early maps, especially one that Mercator did in the 1500s, which showed an open polar sea. And once you get this idea on the map, it becomes harder to dislodge it from the public imagination. So you had all these scientists throughout the 1700s and 1800s trying to prove its existence, almost like trying to prove the existence of God through certain kinds of arguments. Something they have never seen, something no one has ever personally witnessed, and yet there were all these elaborate theories to try to prove why it's there. The leading idea really was this notion, once the Gulf Stream was discovered and studied and people began to realize what a powerful current it was, the notion was that the planet must have some sort of elaborate system for regulating its own heat. The Gulf Stream moves from the tropics north past Norway. No one knew precisely where it went, but the belief was that it tunneled under the ice and somehow went to the North Pole. There's another theory that there were vortexes, whirlpools that led down into the earth, and that the warm water went down into the earth and sort of recirculated itself. So these were some of the we now know to be outlandish theories that informed the expedition.
And this idea really caught the imagination of James Gordon Bennett Jr. Who is he and what was his role here?
Well, Gordon Bennett was one of these outsized Gilded Age characters. He was an extremely wealthy publisher of the New York Herald, which was then the largest paper in the world. And he was the third richest man in Manhattan. A lover of spectacle, a lover of sports and adventure, and he had sent Stanley to Africa to find Livingston and had such enormous success with those dispatches that he was looking for an encore of some sort, a sensation that would be even bigger. And so he had become captivated by the open polar sea theory and also just by Arctic exploration in general, and knew that the public was interested in it. So he decided to bankroll this expedition to the North Pole. It was a U.S. Navy expedition, but the Navy was quite weak in that day, did not really have the funds to mount an expedition of this size. So you got this sort of unique hybrid, which you can't imagine existing today. It's an unorthodox idea that you can't imagine sort of Ted Turner mounting an expedition with NASA, let's say, to go to Mars.
Right.
But that's the way it worked back then, and this arrangement, strange as it was how the Jeannette expedition was born.
The expedition was led by a young Navy lieutenant named George Washington DeLong. Who is he?
Well, DeLong was a young Navy officer who had made a name for himself in Greenland during an earlier expedition, had fallen in love with the ice, and decided that he wanted desperately to be the first man to reach the North Pole and do it for the U.S. Navy. He was a very competent, very thorough, very determined young guy who was a great writer and a great adventurer who just absolutely fell in love with the Arctic.
He was cured of that love, presumably.
Only as the expedition really went south, so to speak. They went north, everything went south, and the expedition really did suffer rather spectacularly dire straits as they drifted in the ice for 2 years and then once the ship finally sank.
I mean, the idea that they got caught in the ice in September and were stuck in the ice for 2 years seems like it could be the story, you know, in and of itself, but that was really just the beginning of the bad news.
Yes. Well, you know, during those 2 years, they drifted very slowly in the ice. And as a writer, as a person trying to craft a narrative, I was concerned about those 2 years because not a whole lot happens. I actually skip an entire year narratively. I just say there's a place where there's a cut, a break, and the next part comes, and it's 1 year later.
How do we know about what happened during those 2 years? What kind of research material did you have to go on?
The survivors had diaries and journals. There was a lot of testimony that was given before naval inquiries and congressional inquiries. DeLong's journals are an amazing source. I mean, every single day, no matter what was happening, he wrote beautifully in his diary. So there's a lot of raw stuff to work with. During the 2 years, you know, there was, you know, it's hard to say this, but they weren't exactly suffering. They were just going slowly mad from boredom and enforced togetherness. One of the men, Dannenhauer, turned out he had syphilis and had to undergo multiple operations on his eye without anesthesia. So there are some medical stories like that. But overall, they have plenty of food and they have plenty of entertainments.
Big supply of Budweiser beer.
Big supply of Budweiser beer, an organ where they have musicals, they have plays, they go hunting out on the ice with great success for polar bear. That's sort of what the 2 years are like. But even though the ship had been massively reinforced for the ice, eventually the ship succumbed to this tremendous pressure of the ice pack and crushed the hull. So DeLong had to very quickly and very thoroughly figure out what supplies to get out on the ice and save before the entire ship went down.
What happened that caused the ship to go down, and what did the 33 men on board then do?
Well, I think some people think the ice is just this nice, placid body of frozen water out there, but it's just constantly warring with the ship for those 2 years. And it makes these terrible sounds and shrieks and shudders. And the ship had been leaking the entire 2 years, and they had been forced to create a whole system of windmills and pumps that were constantly bringing water up from the hull. So finally, two sort of plates of ice that were smashing into each other in what's called a pressure ridge converged on the Jeannette and just absolutely squeezed it, and the ship just went down. So, you know, he got his stuff out on the ice, mainly some food, three small rickety open boats, and organized the men in teams and began marching south towards the nearest landmass, which was Siberia, the central coast of Siberia.
Wonderful, welcoming Siberia.
A place that, you know, is known for being hopeless, a place that had not been mapped sufficiently. You know, the Tsar certainly had figured that out a long time ago. He just sent his exiles out into this prison without bars. So this is where they were heading, and it was pretty bleak. It was about 1,000 miles away, and they had just a few months to do this because winter was coming on. So it was kind of a race against time and a race against calories, and it really was one of the most epic adventures that I've ever encountered, really. The idea of dragging all this stuff across the ice for 3 months it was just extraordinary that they held this thing together. And they did finally reach open water late in the summer of 1881.
Let's not give too much away, since it really does read like a thriller, but how did you come across this story?
I actually heard about this by virtue of doing a story for National Geographic 2 years back about another explorer, a Norwegian explorer named Fridtjof Nansen, who tried to duplicate the voyage of the Jeannette, but in a very, very different kind of vessel, designed very differently for the ice. He wanted to drift in the ice and reach the North Pole that way, and nearly succeeded. But there's a museum dedicated to him and his vessel in Oslo, and everywhere you go there, you see references to the Jeannette. And I'm an American. This is an American voyage. I'd never even heard of it before. So I filed that away and started digging into the source material and decided it was an even better story than Fridtjof Nansen and really one of the great polar stories of all time.
Yeah, I mean, we know so much about, you know, Shackleton, for example. That's
right.
Been a hugely revived, popular story. Why do you think the Jeannette story kind of disappeared?
You know, it was huge in its day. It had its time in the 1880s. Everyone knew about it. And I think it just kind of fell between the cracks. One of those reasons is all the photographs, all the expedition photographs that were taken, went down with the ship. And we're a very visual culture, I think, and that having these images to work with, I think it's been hard for us to kind of envision the story in the way that Shackleton expedition had amazing photos, and the state of photography was much better by then. That expedition wasn't until 1915. So I think that's part of it. The visuals aren't so great. You know, I think it's also just that not many people, for whatever combination of reasons, have written about it since. It's, you know, sometimes it just, someone has to come along and take an interest in a subject and kind of excavate it and bring it to the fore again. And I think now our interest in the Arctic is so intense because of what's happening with climate change. And also our relationship with Russia is changing and is of great interest to us. So I just felt like it was a really good time to revisit the story and try to resurrect it.
What do you think is behind our fascination with these expedition stories, this age of exploration?
Well, I think, you know, in some ways it's kind of a metaphor for anything that life can throw your way. You know, it's like these are extreme stories of hardship and travails, and we'd like to know how would we deal with this situation? How would we survive it, or could we survive it? And I think readers are often asking that as they read these sorts of stories. But in the Arctic, everything is kind of laid bare. There's a kind of a purity to it, to the experience. It's just sort of man versus the elements, and also questions of camaraderie and teamwork, because these men have to save themselves. They have to hold it together, even though they may hate each other, and they often do in these Arctic stories, but they have to pull it together. And the way DeLong held this thing together is one of those extraordinary stories of leadership, and I think that certainly with the Shackleton story, that's part of it, is how do you organize men? How do you motivate men? How do you keep them together in an extremely hard situation? It's kind of a theme of universal appeal.
The story is really tremendous, and I don't want to go too into too many of the details. So thank you so much, Hampton, for joining us.
Well, I appreciate it.
All right. The book, again, is In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. Hampton Sides, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Joining me now is Beth Macy. Her book, Factory Man, How One Furniture Maker Battled Offshoring, Stayed Local, and Helped Save an American Town, is reviewed this week in the Book Review by Mimi Swartz. Hi, Beth.
Hey, Pamela. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So, Factory Man, who is he?
He is John Bassett III. He's a third-generation furniture maker who runs a company in Galax, Virginia called Vaughn Bassett Furniture.
And this is a family-owned company.
Yes. He actually hails originally from Bassett Furniture Company, a company he was thought at his birth in 1937 that he would one day run. But as you know, part of the first part of the book is about kind of how he was elbowed out of that family business in a sort of a corporate coup, family feud, grab by his brother-in-law.
And what happened then?
Then he went to Vaughn Bassett, which was actually run or owned by his wife's family. His wife is also a distant cousin. The book allows me to tell sort of the whole history of Southern Furniture Maker, because most of the companies were all related to Bassett Furniture, which is kind of interesting in itself.
Was this the center of American furniture manufacturing down in the South?
I would say so, yes. Bassett, Virginia, Henry County, and then on into North Carolina, Lexington, Lenoir, a lot of kind of company towns that revolved around furniture making, yes.
And they were traditionally using American wood, presumably, and then manufacturing the furniture on site.
Yes, yes.
And was that primarily for an American market, or was it, had it gone global?
No, it was definitely for an American market. It was huge after World War II, when the baby, you know, boom was happening and the GIs were returning from World War II, and the suburbs were being, the American suburbs were being created. So, you know, that was new housing starts and bedrooms that needed to be furnished, and Bassett Furniture was poised. They had recently conveyorized in the 40s, was poised to become the largest furniture maker in the world.
And they're working with walnut and oak and hickory from Virginia and that whole region.
Right, right. When they started in 1902, the family, you know, was kind of cash poor and land rich, and old man Bassett actually just built his first factory on the riverbank, harnessing the water from the river for the power for the factory, and built a factory in his front yard, and using the woods from the hills, you know, the Blue Ridge foothills, that were on his land, and a lot of the workers came from sharecropping and subsistence farming, and eager to join the cash economy and, you know, the Industrial Revolution, and sort of carved out this little sort of peculiar company town world.
And when it, at first glance you look at the title Factory Man, an assumption might be that we're talking about factory workers. But in fact, Bassett is the owner of this company. What makes him the hero of your story?
Right. Well, he took on China in 2002. A lot of imports, I think maybe a third of what was being sold in this country was already imports at that point. And this one particular dresser came on the scene that was really threatening. This one particular suit of bedroom furniture came on the scene in the early aughts that was really threatening to take the whole industry down. And he took a look at it. He had his workers deconstruct it in his factory, take it apart piece by piece to prove to himself that the Chinese were cheating, i.e. they were illegally dumping, which means they were selling the product for less than it cost even the raw materials in an effort to capture the American market share. And he went to China, to northern China, where this piece was coming from. He didn't know exactly where. And, you know, there's this moment in the book at the beginning where he sent his son and a translator sort of undercover to pretend like they're going to be buying this piece. But actually, they're just looking to see what factory it came from so that they can then go back and file what was at the time the largest anti-dumping petition against China in 2003 is when they filed it.
And what was the result?
They won the case in 2005, unanimous vote by the U.S. International Trade Commission, and then they won it again at the Sunset hearing in 2010, and it resulted in millions in duties coming back to the American domestic furniture makers. Of course, by 2010, many of them had already closed down.
I was going to say, I mean, is this sort of a little win in a kind of losing war against Chinese imports?
I would say so, yes. I mean, he is virtually the only large bedroom manufacturer left. He put the money, the duties that he got, back into his factories. Some of the other companies that won duties were already so far into imports that they basically used it to buttress their importing operations. Some companies went into retail and used that money to buttress that. You know, he used it to keep his factory going in Galax.
Give us a sense of the scale here, the American furniture business. What was it at its peak, and what is it now?
Right. Well, Bassett Furniture, which was, you know, kind of the test case for this book, and at one point in the late 80s, it was selling $510 million worth of furniture a year in sales, and it was Fortune 500 for a couple years, and now it's about half that, or a little bit less, actually. It was hurt a lot by the housing recession. And the same is true with Vaughn Bassett Furniture. They're making about half what they once were because they're still kind of waiting on this housing market to come back.
Mm-hmm. What led you into the story? You're the daughter of a factory worker.
Yeah, I grew up in a town not unlike Galax, Virginia, Urbana, Ohio, and the big daddy business was called Grimes Manufacturing. It was bought by Honeywell a couple decades ago. But my mom was one of those women who worked on these long cavernous tables under poorly lit in these little Quonset hut type buildings, and she soldered airplane lights. And, you know, that job has since been replaced by machinery. The factory, which is now owned by Honeywell, now does a lot of offshoring itself, you know, employs about half the number that it employed when I was growing up there. I tell everybody that at the very beginning of the book, that I'm the daughter of a displaced factory worker. I sort of lay my cards out. This is where my heart lies in the story. This is kind of the question that sent me to Martinsville and Henry County to begin with. What happened to 20,000 people that lost their jobs in that community, which turns out to be half of the workforce? I mean, did they get employed again? I mean, these were the questions that sort of sent me down there to begin with to report on the aftermath of globalization. And that's when I heard there's this one guy who's managed to bulk the trend. That's always, you know, kind of an interesting story, the person who does the counterintuitive thing. And then when I met him, he was just such a larger-than-life character. I thought, wow, this guy could be a book.
You know, it really kind of turns the traditional factory, manufacturing, sort of union, Meituan kind of story on its head, because it's not the workers versus the factory owner here, really. It's almost like the two of them brought together against these larger forces.
But, I mean, if you look at the facts, he's 76 years old. He's a multimillionaire with two homes in exclusive communities. He didn't have to do any of this. Maybe it is kind of more about his ego than it is about the factory workers, but I've met a lot of those workers, and I've seen him interact with them, and I think he did it to protect, like, his family legacy. I think he really cares about those people that for generations made his family rich.
Was he a willing participant in your research and the telling of this story?
It was baby steps. He was, he's difficult. I mean, he talks about what he wants to talk about. He calls when he wants to call, night, day, weekend. The cool thing, like, as a reporter, you probably know, it's kind of hard to get CEOs on the phone or to get them to open up.
Oh, yes.
It's kind of the opposite problem. I mean, he called me night and day. Yesterday, he called three times. I mean, access was not an issue. And one of the things I appreciated about him was once he got, like, the kind of book I was trying to do, he would give me phone numbers and names of people that he knew would say bad things about him. And that's kind of rare, too.
What was his reaction reading the book?
I think he wishes certain parts weren't in the book. He calls it Peyton Place meets Gone with the Wind. He gives me no credit at all for, you know, all the economic analysis I did and, you know, the hard kind of thinking about globalization and the business problems. And you think it's more gossipy than he would like.
Right.
You know, I really tried to write the kind of book that I could give to my mom and she would understand why the town that she worked in is like it is now, you know? I try to report it from the ground up and write the kind of book that would really explain why it is when you drive through Bassett, Virginia, it looks like a ghost town.
Right. You did say that that it's hard to get CEOs on the phone here. What about when you went over to China? Was it hard to get people to talk to you?
Well, it was hard to convince a furniture company to let me even go see the factories where their stuff is made. And so I asked Stanley Furniture, which was the last factory in the region I'm reporting on, to close a big factory. They closed the plant in Stanleytown, Virginia in 2010. And I started asking them, gosh, about 9 months before they actually let me go. Part of it was just scheduling issues. But, you know, they were concerned. The story with the Apple workers at Foxconn had just broke. So they just came out and said, we don't want a story on working conditions. We don't own the factories there.
Right.
And I just said, mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't want a story about our executives' lush lifestyles in Indonesia. And I said, mm-hmm. You know, of course, those were the two things I was then looking for.
Right.
Said that. But they were very kind. And they let me into three of the 10 factories where most of their stuff is made now, in and around Surabaya. And that was really interesting. And they didn't, I mean, they weren't just the clean, super nice factories either. So I felt like we got a pretty good, you know, look at what that's like. And we got, they let us interview some people who had just been, you know, working in the rice paddies a few months, a few years before, and who I imagine, like the early workers at Bassett Furniture in 1902, you know, were enjoying it because they got to send their children to school. They got to work indoors for the first time and get money, you know, get paid actual money instead of just food. But the interesting kind of takeaway from that is they were very cognizant of the fact that their wages were rising, and that was both a good thing and a bad thing because they totally understand that those jobs could move to the next cheaper
country. The next Indonesia. Do you see a way, after doing all this research and writing the book, to reverse this, or did you come up with ideas of, you know, did it seem like this is a fait accompli and there's nothing that can be done, or is there a way for other companies like Bassett to sort of battle this offshoring trend?
You know, they talk about reshoring, and I think the Boston Consulting Group had predicted that 5 million factory jobs will return to the U.S. by next year, and that is not showing to be the case. I think maybe 500,000 have come back in the latest figures that I saw. So it's still just a trickle. I mean, for people who were managed to keep their manufacturing going, and like John Bassett in Galax, I mean, he's poised to be, as he put it, the last woman among 12 men standing on a desert island. You know, you are going to get the business.
Right.
You know, if you never went cheap with the other woman down the street, you know, you don't have to come drag Assen back. That's one of his great quotes. He's ready to expand as soon as the housing market improves again. But, you know, in general, those kinds of jobs have left the U.S. and, you know, don't seem like they're in a rush to come back. Now, with the rising wages in China and other parts in Asia, maybe that could happen.
Did you end up feeling pessimistic about the state of American manufacturing?
In some ways, yes. I was going to end the book with the end of chapter 27. In fact, that was what it was in my book proposal. It was supposed to end there, you know, with this heroic moment where he is opening a vacant plant next door and calling it Von Bassett 2, and he's going to create 115 more jobs, and that was going to be this great ending. And then I realized that what he's done is such an outlier in the grand scheme of things. And one day I was driving back from Bassett, and I was just feeling so moved by what I had seen and all the people I had talked to. And I had just been driving around, and I stumbled upon a man with a backhoe who was burying the remains of Bassett Superior Lines, which was the last factory that closed. And it was at one point the most profitable factory in the history of the industry. And he was saying, you know, if you'd have told Bassett that I'd be burying this plant 10 years ago, they'd have said you were crazy. And here he was, and there was a stack of really beautiful aligned bricks that he had placed over to the side. And I said, what's that? And he goes, oh, those are the keepsake bricks, because people want a brick. They want this tangible thing to take and put in their home. And it was like, I was here. I did this. This work was important to me. It was important to my family. The government said when free trade happened and China joined the WTO in 2001, this was going to be a win-win for everybody, and we'd export more goods to the growing consumer classes in Asia, but that didn't really happen. And in some ways, those commemorative bricks that the guy actually handed me one at the end of the book, it was kind of like proof that didn't turn out the way we wanted.
Wow. Well, the book again is Factory Man: How One Furniture Maker Battled Offshoring, Stayed Local, and Helped Save an American Town, by Beth Macy. It is also on the bestseller list this week at number 14. Beth, thank you so much, and congratulations again.
Thank you so much, Pamela. I really appreciate it.
Greg Coles is on vacation this week, but we have John Williams here with Bestseller News. Hi, John.
Hey, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, there are three new books on the hardcover fiction list and on the hardcover nonfiction list, and all of the action is sort of toward the upper reaches of the lists. Let's start with nonfiction. At number 7, there is The Invisible Bridge, which is Rick Perlstein's third book out of what I think is now a planned 4, about essentially conservatism in America from the time of Barry Goldwater to Ronald Reagan. This covers a period in the mid-70s. from basically Nixon's fall to the start of the rise of Reagan, which
and
eventually led to his presidency.
Reviewed on the cover by Frank Rich.
It was. Been getting a lot of attention. Number four, another presidentially themed book but very different, is The First Family Detail by Ronald Kessler. This is a look at some secretive details about the Secret Service and things that Kessler has discovered, and it tends a little bit toward the salacious, things that presidents said that maybe they shouldn't have or things that Secret Service agents did that maybe they shouldn't have. And I think it's for people who are really looking to dig into dirt. Number three is In the Kingdom of Ice by Hampton Sides. And Mr. Sides was on the program earlier, and you spoke to him about this, so I won't say too much. It's about a 19th century trip to the North Pole that went horribly awry. And that's the highest new book on the nonfiction list at number three.
What's on fiction?
On fiction at number four is Severed Souls by Terry Goodkind. And this is the third book in his Richard and Kalan series. And these are characters that come from his epic Sword of Truth series, which has, I think, at least a dozen books in it. At number three, just above that, is Lost Island by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child, longtime co-writers. And this is the third Gideon Crew book, and it involves a page from the Book of Kells manuscript, the beautiful illustrated book, and a treasure map that leads people on a big chase.
And Doug Preston in the headlines this week with leading the Authors United effort.
Yes, with his letter to Amazon, trying to rally his fellow authors against some of Amazon's negotiating practices. And at the very top of the list, we have a new number one.
But it's also a third.
It's a third book in a series, and it concludes a trilogy. It's The Magician's Land by Lev Grossman, which is, of course, the magic for adults series that sort of plays with and against things like Harry Potter and The Lord of the Rings to tell the story about a young man who discovers that a Narnia-like world that he loved as a child is actually real, and that he has a great talent for magic. And so the reviews for this book have been very positive, and they've also, I think, most reviewers I've seen have taken the time to kind of look back and praise the trilogy as a whole and not just this conclusion to it.
Interestingly, in Parle Sagel's Inside the List column this week, she says that Lev based the books not so much on Harry Potter, but on Brideshead Revisited, that this was not about Hogwarts, but in fact about Oxford in the 1920s. So listeners, let us know if that analogy seems to hold up for them.
Some of those Harry Potter fans are going to have to go back now and read Brideshead.
All right. Well, a week of third in a series, it seems, on the bestseller list. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.